saying Parin Jada reminded me that years ago I had said to her, growing old must be really terrible. That was projecting before the experience. Actually, it's not as bad as you might think. It does have some redeeming quality. Of course, there's a downside to growing older. There's always a downside. It's like the story of the two old people who have been friends for a long time, and they're sitting around talking, and one says to the other, "Are you worried about dying?" And the friend says, "No, I'm not really worried about dying. I'm much more worried about the hereafter." And the first friend says, "Gee, I didn't even realize you believed in those things. What do you mean?" Well, the second friend says, "You know what it's like. And you get up in the middle of the night and you kind of stumble around. You walk downstairs, walk into the kitchen and look around and say, what is it I'm here after?" So there is a downside, there's a reason why you don't retain short-term memory quite as long. The body's saying, your child-bearing and child-rearing years are behind you now. So there are certain chemicals that you just don't need anymore. And it just so happens that some of those chemicals are linked with retention of short-term memories. So it's also why it's harder to stay trim. We don't burn up calories quite as efficiently as you do when you're younger, and you have to try harder to stay in good shape. So there are some downsides. But there's an upside as well. I think the upside is that you're not so young anymore to be as naive as you used to be, and you're not so old that you're useless. You have some knowledge, some wisdom, some experience, and you can put that to work. So I think Prabhupada wanted us to do that. He wanted us to take whatever our particular experiences were in this lifetime and put them to work, put them to good use. He called that the art of work in the Bhagavad Gita, the art of living, the art of transforming whatever gifts were given by Krishna in this lifetime into tools for devotional service. So by Prabhupada's grace, my particular field is teaching. I teach both within university environments and also at yoga schools. It's fascinating being in yoga schools these days. I think yoga studios are becoming what churches used to be. A place where people go for some inspiration, for good community, for meeting with friends and so on. One of the toughest things that's happening in the yoga classes that I'm involved with right now is that people are a little confused about Krishna. We talk about Krishna. How do you teach Bhagavad Gita without talking about Krishna? And they have a hard time getting their arms around this idea that Krishna is actually a person. And I'll confess something to you here, because it's just the six of us in the room, right? No one else is listening. And that is that up until maybe even just a few years ago, I would have to admit that my devotional service was more to an idea of Krishna than to the person Krishna. It's only been in recent years, as I'm getting older, and maybe a little bit, I don't know if I'm getting smarter, but maybe a little more experienced, that Krishna, the person, is becoming more real to me. That's been an astonishing revelation. That's been a wonderful, wonderful change in my life. Instead of seeing the deities and wondering what is it exactly I'm looking at, there's a sense from perhaps a tiny little bit of sincerity and the power of Krishna consciousness, really, and the chanting, that there's a sense that we're dealing with real people. Radha and Krishna are real people. They're not ideas. They're real people. And if you just look at the Bhagavad Gita, by sheer quantity of verses, Krishna says at least 35 or 40 times in 700 verses, depending on how you calculate it, that I am with you, me, this person, I am with you, I'm in your heart. He keeps repeating that over and over and over again. He's really insisting that Arjuna understand that there's a personal relationship here. That I'm not distant, I'm not far away, I'm with you, I'm in your heart. And I care deeply about you. That's another thing that's said quite often in Bhagavad Gita. It's surprising how many times Krishna reminds Arjuna that the reason I'm sharing this knowledge with you is that I love you. you're my friend, you're my dearmost friend, and I love you, and so I trust you. You know, you don't confide your deepest secrets to just anybody. You confide your secrets to someone whom you trust, someone who won't betray you, who won't take that knowledge and misuse it. So the whole message of Bhagavad Gita is, I trust you because you're my friend, because you love me and I love you. And I guess when I think about Srila Prabhupada, that's what I think about most. I think of someone who understood Krishna as a person, who knew Krishna as a person, and who was extending that trust and that confidence to us as well, to take those teachings to heart. So, I don't know, what would you like to know about? The name of subject, we used to do this in Gurukul. We'd say, pick a topic or an object, and you know, then the teacher would have to come up with a Prabhupada story about that. Apple, you know, oh, well, I'm gonna tell a story about Prabhupada and an apple. So, I know everyone likes Prabhupada stories. I'll do my best. So we'll take questions from the audience here. What's important to you? What's on your mind? It's hard for me to almost see you well because you've all taken refuge in the corners of the temple. And we've got this large temple room and you've all taken shelter of the farthest extremities, you know, like you're hiding out there, but I can still see you. Yes, what's your name, please? Madhava Dasa? Yes, Madhava Prabhu. Haribol.
The aging process.
Things Prabhupada said about the aging process? Well, you know, on different levels he talked about it. Huh?
From direct experience.
From my experience. Yes, well, you know, there were times he would just talk about how amazing it is that he's getting older. You know, in Paris, he would look at his hands, he said, I don't feel old. You know, and the way he would behave, you know, it was very, you know, somewhat objective, I guess, about the frailties of the body. You know, like, well, that's not working today, or that's not working today. You know, and he'd go on. You know, there was one of my godbrothers who was traveling with Prabhupada, and in Rome, Prabhupada called me in, and usually when he would call me, he would pronounce the Y like J's. In Bengal, you know, the Y's sound like J's, so he'd say, Jogeshwar. And I'd come scurrying into his room, and then he'd look up and say, you know, why is this devotee always complaining about his health? I said, well, I don't know. The Prabhupada said, I have trouble traveling by plane, and it hurts my knees all the time, but I don't talk about it. You know, the body's the body. What do you expect from the body? So he was, but he was also very respectful of older people. He knew to accord older people the honor and respect that they had earned by their life experiences. And he was very polite. He was polite to everybody, but particularly to older people. He was always looking out for their comfort. You know, if someone would come to see him who was an older person, he'd say, bring a chair, please bring a chair, and so on. And so he was sensitive to that. And we know from his life that he preferred to die on the battlefield. He didn't want to go quietly into that dark night. You know, that wasn't his way. You know, so he was always encouraging us to rally our forces. I think that maybe sums up best what my impression of Prabhupada's attitude was toward aging. Don't give in prematurely. If there are two things that I've learned in my 1969, so was that 40 years of Krishna consciousness? 40 years, whoa. It's that what you're seeing is much more profound than it seems. Whatever the story is that you're looking at, whatever the circumstances of your life may be, it's much deeper than it appears to be on the surface. That's the first thing I've understood. The second thing I've understood is, by God's grace, you are capable of much more than you think. And I would have to say that that sums up Prabhupada's attitude toward old age, that you're capable of more. Don't give in prematurely. You have a lot to offer. Your experiences in your life are very valuable, very, very important. I remember quoting a book to Prabhupada one time that I had read, you know, earlier in my life, that I thought was, you know, a karmic book. And it was called The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris, who's a paleontologist who, essentially in this book, he was describing how human behavior is nothing but sophisticated animal behavior. We shake hands, as a way of showing I don't have any weapons, or we, put on scents, perfumes, or deodorants, or whatever, as a way of being attractive to others. It's basically the same thing that animals do in their own way. And I was asking Prabhupada, what did he think of, the book? And I thought Prabhupada would pan it and say, well, no, that's a lot of speculation. He said, yes, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely correct. He said, without Krishna consciousness, without knowledge of God, we are animals. Everything we do is just... He said, you should use this book in your preaching. So he never dismissed the experiences of our lifetime. He wanted us to go deeper inside the experiences of our lifetime, to find Krishna in the details there, and to employ that, engage that. The thing that I'm told that the classes, the Gita classes that I've been asked to give at places like Jivamukti Yoga School in New York are well received. And there are a lot of people who come to them. And the thing that seems to be most valuable for people is that I do try to find ways of connecting it with the world we live in. That's something that Prabhupada did all the time, and I try to follow his example. Just finding ways of connecting what's going on in the world today, the world of relevance to people, to our philosophy. So in other words, accept people from what their life experiences are. Honor them for having lived their life as best they can. And then maybe you earn their trust and you can bring them into the world of Krishna consciousness. Yes. Yes. What's your name? Mahendrani? Hare Krishna. Nice to meet you.
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to say that even though there's a couple people in the room, there's lots of people on the internet that listen, even all over the world, and then it's archived, so devotees go back and listen to it later. So you do have a big audience, even if they're not in front of you.
You're trying to get me scared, aren't you?
When you talked about as you grew older, one of the things that happened is you became more aware of Krishna as a person. I've also found that, but I had the opposite experience from yours, that as I became more aware of that he is a person with his own likes and dislikes, it challenged, maybe because I tend to be introverted, impersonal maybe, a little selfish, a perfectionist. So seeing Krishna, his personality a little more clearly, I started to feel I lack of confidence that I can fit in. He's playful. He teases a lot. I know that that's my material personality. But therefore the goal that looked so wonderful to me, because really I was looking at it as how I will enjoy in the spiritual world, serving, but my comfort. I don't know if I'm making this clear, but I would love to have a day filled with devotional service, but it included how I was going to be comfortable in my way.
Sure.
But his associates have totally opposite attitude,
right.
And
right.
That felt very challenging. I said, I don't know if I'm going to make it there. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I know. We have these impressions of the spiritual world that sometimes seem... I'd never fit in there. I mean, I just don't really like cows all that much, kind of thing. You're look, introspective, feeling selfish. Hey, welcome to my world. I mean, everyone has that situation. You're really not alone there. I mentioned a moment ago, one of the big problems or challenges in the yoga circles is that from the first day that most people set foot in a yoga school in the United States, they hear about the Advaita Vedanta idea that we all become one. You lose your individuality. When you achieve samadhi, you know, you get to the end of the road of Patanjali yoga, you become one with God. You become God. I mean, that's what they know. That's what they've been taught. And there are reasons, there are historic reasons for that, why it is that primarily the South Indian, you know, Mayavad school of teachers were the ones who came over in the 60s when what was called the Asian Exclusion Act was reversed in 1963, and finally there was this wave of immigration from India, and the teachers were finally allowed in, and so many of them came from the Shankarite school. And they're the ones who set up the various yoga schools in America. Prabhupada was unique in that way. He was the first bhakti teacher, really, who came to America and declared emphatically, it's Krishna, it's Krishna, it's Krishna. So from day one, people go to yoga schools and they're confronted with this idea that being a person is bad, that your body is something to transcend, you know, that the world around you is an illusion. It's something to transcend. It's something to get out of. And along comes Srila Prabhupada and says, these are the tools of your devotional service. And the world is your arena for devotional service. Embrace it. I did my master's thesis on this. You know, it's called Engaged Vaishnavism. That you look at the history of all of our acharyas, and what they say is, this is not a dream. This is not an illusion. It may be dreamlike. It may be a temporary reality, but it's not a dream. It's not an illusion. This is real. Don't turn your back on this. So you're not alone. People have this difficulty incorporating their own personhood into this larger portrait of a spiritual world where personhood continues perpetually. Why do they have such problems? Because being a person has been such a problem. All of the pain, suffering, misery, arguments, disappointments, failings, broken relationships, it's all because of people. You know, it's like what they say about France. France would be great if it weren't for the French. I mean, you know, the problem that we're having is we have this material impression of what it means to be a person. And it's always been lousy. You know? So, you know, you got to think of it. You know, why would impersonal be so attractive? You know, it's like obliterating your personality, your selfhood. I mean, what could be scarier than that? I mean, psychologically, if you go to the schools of psychology, the Vienna schools and the more recent schools of psychology, transpersonal psychology, self-psychology, Hans Kohut, and other, you know, progressive thinkers in the world of psychology, it's that notion of loss of self that lies at the basis of all neuroses. The idea that I might not be a person, that I might not count. It's also what often becomes problematic in sex, sexuality, is the idea that if this person, you know, do you love me or is it just my body that you want? You know, that sense of this detachment from me as a real person. So in the discussions, especially recently in Jiva Mukti, the topic has been Krishna as a person, and the idea of, well, all right, why do we have such a hard time embracing the sense that I'm a person and God is a person, and the goal of yoga is reawakening that relationship. Well, first of all, relationships have always been disappointing. Secondly, if we collapse the universe of possibilities of the divine to this one specificity called Krishna, is that not somehow sectarian? Are we not now eliminating Jesus? Are we not now eliminating Buddha? Are we not now eliminating Shiva? Are we not now eliminating Allah? You know, has everyone else now been kind of knocked out of the picture because we've boiled everything down just to Krishna? So that's another objection that people have. Another objection that people have is that it seems anthropomorphic. You know, we're just projecting because we can't envision something unlimited, so we have to have a deity to focus on, you know, and that's kind of simplistic. You know, the idea of form is limiting. We don't have experience of unlimited form. Krishna's form is unlimited. We've never experienced that. And we've also never had experience of someone who would never betray our trust. Except Prabhupada, or Radhanath Swami. Yeah. There are a few people. But generally, other than the great exalted souls, you know, we distrust people. Because most people are insecure. Most people, you know, look, we live so close to these bodies, and these bodies are vulnerable. They can be hurt. We live so close to our mind and our ego and our sense of ourselves, and those things are vulnerable. They can be hurt. So we throw up these defenses. You know, Jai Prabhu, that's a defense. You know, when we don't really want anyone to get inside us, we take on the trappings of being Vaishnava. No, I'm serious. I mean, it's probably the biggest failing of the first generation, my generation of devotees, is that we were very impersonal. You know, we were more concerned with posturing than with communicating, you know, really being open and honest with one another. We didn't know how to talk. We didn't know how to do that. And the result is that people got very lonely and a lot of broken hearts out there, you know, because we didn't trust opening ourselves up, because then it means someone else can come and hurt us, right? So sometimes we project that material experience onto Krishna. How can I trust him? I've given my heart so many times before and it's always been broken. How can I give my heart again? How can I trust this? Especially when it comes with all of these crazy Indian trappings, you know. Someone asked the first day of Bhagavad Gita class this term at Jiva Mukti. Someone said, can you explain, you know, the idea of elephant-headed gods and four-armed deities, you know, and four-headed deities and serpent deities, and you know, I was saying, whoa. I'll tell you what, let's table that till we have a little bit more of a background on, you know, the self and what the self can be. And you know, just whew, let's put that one aside for a while. Yeah. It comes with all these trappings that, what is this mythology around it? You know, sure, okay, God, I'll talk with you about it. But all the rest of it? You know, what's all of that? So it does come with this imagery that's very specific. And since that imagery is so specific to India, does it mean that somebody who's brought up, let's say, in the Christian faith, with a very different set of images of God and the spiritual realm, so does that mean they're kind of like out of the box? You know, that they've got the wrong idea? You know, that if someone truly loves Jesus, right, that they're totally off base, because their imagery has nothing to do with Krishna and Vrindavan. They're focusing on the wrong thing. Their meditation is wrong somehow. Or if someone is thinking of Allah, you know, and loves God, you know, according to the Islamic faith, are they, you know, condemned? You know, are we guilty of the same kind of salvationist thinking as the conservative Christian community? That if you don't love Krishna in Vrindavan, you're basically condemned. These aren't easy questions. I'm not going to claim to have all the answers for you. But what I can say is that set aside the anomalies. I think this is Krishna's message to Arjuna. After he reveals the universal form to Arjuna, Arjuna goes through this kind of question. He says, I thought I knew who you are. I haven't a clue. Having seen what I've just seen, I don't know what you are. I don't know who you are. All I know is, please accept my humble obeisances. Because it's too much. I can't take it. Please just, whatever it is, remove it. Whoever you are, please go away. Bring me back my friend. And it's so upsetting to him that the very first verse of the 12th chapter seems so out of whack that some scholars think the 12th chapter was added to the Gita later on historically, because it doesn't seem to follow at all. The first verse of the 12th chapter, Arjuna is asking Krishna, so tell me, he goes into this heavy philosophical thing. So which is higher, worshipping you in your personal form or worshipping you as impersonal energy? And you're thinking, where does that come from? He's just been through this emotionally devastating experience, the encounter with Virata Rupa, the universal form. And here he's asking this philosophical question. Well, how are we going to interpret that? Well, either the Bhagavad Gita is just this artificial construct, you know, for presenting wisdom teachings. You know, you've got this story of the Mahabharata, right? And you know, as just like a build-up, you know, so that Krishna can give these teachings to humanity, because someday in Florida, in this little place in Florida, they're going to need to sit there and hear somebody talking about the wisdom, you know. Or else they really are people. And if you accept Arjuna and Krishna as real people, then you have to go inside the experience that Arjuna was having at that moment. And what might he actually be saying? Because, you know, we humans, we're complex creatures. We don't always say what we really feel. So having gone what he's gone through, my understanding, both from my studies of Prabhupada's teachings and my own tiny little realization, is that Arjuna was saying, if I cannot accept this dark side of you, the pain, the suffering, the death and destruction that goes on in this world that you've just revealed to me comes from you, if I can't reconcile the fact that there is this side to your nature, and I'm having a hard time embracing you, knowing that you're capable of this, of putting people, this is your world, you set up the rules here. You could have done it in some other way, but you set up these rules. And if I'm having a hard time embracing the idea that you would put people through such suffering, or if somebody has that, maybe it's better that I just worship you as the impersonal Brahman. Maybe I should just accept that God is some impersonal energy, so I don't have to deal with the pain and suffering. In other words, which is what most people hear in the yoga schools, it doesn't exist. Pain doesn't exist. It's an illusion. And then you can feel better about yourself. Sometimes the reality of Krishna is so complex, so deep, so hard to understand, that we would prefer some simplistic answer, because then we can go about our day. We can go back to chanting our rounds and doing whatever we have to do without having to think too deeply about it. So my understanding, and your question is really quite relevant and quite important. We're meant to think very deeply about these things. And setting aside the particulars of the imagery of what goes on in the spiritual world, we're not ready for that yet. That's postgraduate stuff. Here is our spiritual world, here and now. And Krishna is with us here and now. Go inside what you have. The life you have is perfect. Now that may be hard to accept. Perfect doesn't mean perfection. Perfect doesn't mean trouble-free. Perfect means that the journey that you need to go on to come to Radha and Krishna's lotus feet is the journey that is already in front of you. What you need, you have been provided. That's in Bhagavad Gita. You don't need some other life. You have to go some other. Of course, sometimes we have to go somewhere else. I'm not condemning going somewhere else. You know, I mean, let's be real. If you're in an abusive situation, get out of it. But the life you have is complete with all the tools that we need for realizing Krishna. Is that okay? Bhishkar Prabhu.
Elderly people. And during the art department days, you know, Devahuti was older than the other artists, and he specifically in several letters had said they should set aside a special place for her and give her special respect, don't bug her. But somehow or other, I don't know how it worked, because I was in L.A. and she came from New York or Boston. They just moved. And she said she couldn't get along with Bhardwaj and the other artists. Jadarani were lording over her. And I didn't know about those letters then. This was 70, you know. And I was already jacked up to go to New York or Boston and work with the artists. And here she's coming. And she was like in her 40s then, you know. And we were in the 20s.
That was old back then. 40
yeah.
was old. Yeah.
We, yeah. Now, you look around, go in Harinam, you find a 40-year-old, you think they're like a kid, a teenager, mostly everybody's white hair. You know. But so, so, apparently they couldn't follow it. There was an assembly line of artists, you know, and she, but she did nice paintings on her own. But he was very clear about it. Don't bug her, let her do her own paintings, even though he knew they were working together. But somehow or other, she just felt alienated. Maybe because she couldn't work with the others or wanted to, but she just said she couldn't work with them. So they weren't able to follow that. Either they weren't able to follow Prabhupada's specifics in this manner, in this specific thing, you know.
Well, we've had to make a lot of adjustments. We've had to make a lot of adjustments to understand the character of what it means to be a devotee of Krishna, Radha and Krishna. Gosh, that's a very, very elevated thing. And the qualities are sometimes difficult to cultivate. Even something that should be as simple as respecting elders, you know, we don't always get it. But how many times in the Bhagavad Gita, how many times does Krishna tell Arjuna that someone who is respectful to others, someone who is compassionate to others, someone who by virtue of their own experience appreciates the experience of others, such a person is most dear to me. How many times does he say that in the Bhagavad Gita? You know, again and again and again, he's saying, cultivate the qualities of a Vaishnava. What does it mean to be a devotee of Krishna? You know, I mean, it's character. You can't separate character. It's all about character and behavior. That's really what a devotee is someone who knows how to receive someone respectfully and make them feel comfortable. That's what we remember. People don't remember philosophy. They don't remember philosophy. But if you're nice to them, you know, if you're courteous and, you know, certainly if you're sensitive to the fact that they're older and may need some consideration, they'll come back. I remember when we went on the, what was the name of that TV show back in this David Susskind show in 70 or 71? I don't remember. Oh, yeah, I was, you know, and we went on there and he had us chanting and, you know, it was me and Rukmini and Bhardwaj and Rupanuga and maybe one or two other devotees. And that was like, this was like Oprah of the 1970s, like the most popular show on television in America. And, you know, we had a kirtan, he was asking us questions and, you know. For weeks afterwards, we'd be on the street on Harinam or whatever, and people would come up to us and say, "Oh, I saw you on David Susskind. You looked so happy." They didn't remember a thing about what we were saying. They didn't remember a thing about the philosophy. But, "Oh, you look so happy." That's what impressed them. You know, the character. That's what impresses people.
In Gainesville, and the guy was asking him, "Well, what, Swamiji, what should we know about your followers? How would we, what do you, would be the most salient point?" And say, "They're perfect gentlemen."
Yes. Yes. He was very proud of that. He wanted that most of all. He wanted his students, his followers, his disciples to be perfect gentlemen, gentlewomen. Because you don't see that. Nobody sees that.
Also, when Prabhupada went up to the Indian embassy, Kirtiraj was there, and can tell you more specifically, and I think Shrutakirti, and Prabhupada kind of spoke very heavily in Hindi to this man, people there. Afterwards, when they came out, they said, "Prabhupada, you really were heavy with those guys." He said, "Yes, but they don't take it seriously because I'm an old man." So he said, "You cannot get away with this." Of course, couldn't get away with it as a joke. I mean, his 75-year-old speaking their language with a purpose to it, you know, it's like the hitting in the throat. You see somebody hit the donkey in the throat to get the grapefruit to go down. So sometimes we think that we can get away with stuff that Acharya can get away with. We can't.
Well, maybe now that we're a little bit grayer, we'll get some respect. Anyway, I was told that we had only until 8:30 because you're going off to Rath Yatra today.
Well, so whoever's going is not even here. They're already standing by the buses and getting plates. You see them walk by.
Oh, so we should go on for a
I'm going at 9:30 and not going.
Whatever you would like me to do.
Yeah, you can keep talking.
So are there some other questions anyone would like to?
I heard your comment about getting older. You know, I was on the radio, but I saw a little humorous something where it said, by the time you're old enough to know what steps to take, you're too old to take steps. But that's the cynical side.
That's the cynical side, yeah. We have a different point of view. We become more productive. We don't get old. I think we get ripe.
Can I ask you something about the... I didn't read a George Harrison book, but I will sometime, but there was some mood when it was coming out that it might not be something that the family would like we've overdone it using George's name. Now, what was the reaction with the family about the book? You probably know better than anyone else. Did you get any feedback?
I didn't get any letters from the family one way or the other. So, I'm not sure. But it was respectful. I mean, there was some contact. I tried to reach them in the beginning of writing that book about George. And so there was, from what I heard, the little feedback that I got, there was appreciation that it was a respectful biography. And it wasn't attempting to appropriate George, you know, for...
sensationalism
or, you know, for... He was just for Krishna. I mean, one of the wonderful things about George was he actually did appreciate the many different ways that people can express their love for God. I mean, he was very respectful and appreciative of, you know, many different traditions, and he wasn't an exclusivist. He wasn't sectarian in that way. Look at even in his early albums, which were all about Krishna, he incorporated gospel music. You know, he incorporated, you know, Christian prayers, you know, hallelujah. And, you know. I mean, there was so much love for God in him that he could appreciate that in others. And that's what Prabhupada, you want to ask about what it was like to be with Prabhupada. It was like, it was being with someone who knew how to appreciate others. Very, very wonderful to see that, how he could appreciate other people. Just because they may not be devotees yet, or, you know, and he saw the soul in the body, and he was very respectful of that. And always had a kind word. Always had a kind word.
And sometimes they appreciated it, but they didn't. Sometimes they didn't. I was thinking specifically, one time a scholar came along with his students. And it was very evident to everyone there that he had come just to defeat Prabhupada. That was his only intention. And Prabhupada, he was a teacher of Hinduism. So Prabhupada asked him, what is Hinduism? And the professor said, I don't know. And I think he was demonstrating his extreme scholarship by admitting that it was too much to grasp. And then Prabhupada asked one of his disciples, you probably know who. So he said that... He doesn't know what Hinduism, but he is teaching Hinduism. What do you think? And the disciple said, he's a cheater, Prabhupada. So then Prabhupada turned to the professor and said, so he has called you a cheater. What can you say to this? What is your reply? And in the end, Prabhupada told him, you don't want a guru, you simply want a Sanskrit teacher. And he told him to get out. He told him to leave. And then Brahmananda told him, you know, big Brahmananda came and said, you have to go. So, because we don't know what the long-term effect was on that professor, how years later that might have affected him very positively. So I just wondered if you had any comments about that. Sometimes Prabhupada would be like that.
That was Prabhupada's greatness, that just coming into his presence, people understood that he was not an ordinary person. And so he had the prerogative of exercising certain discretions in the way he would interact with people that are above and beyond our abilities. When Prabhupada would chastise someone or alert them to a mistake that they might be making, most of the time people, as you said, they would walk away feeling properly chastised and purified by that experience, you know, enlightened by that experience. They didn't take it as an offense. Prabhupada was never offensive. He might have been strong, but he wasn't offensive. He called a spade, and if someone was posing as a teacher without the proper qualifications, Prabhupada would point it out. He would point it out not only because he didn't want other people misled by such a person, but because he didn't want that person to be hurting himself or herself. There was compassion in it. I was there at those kinds of moments. I was there. I heard it. There was a Jean Herbert. Jean Herbert was a big scholar from Geneva University. He was a big scholar. And you know, he came into Prabhupada's room in Geneva and he sat down. He had written a book called I think it was called Krishna the Divine Lover or something. And in the book, everything was metaphor. The gopis were a metaphor. Krishna was a metaphor. The dust raised by the hooves of the calves was a metaphor. Everything was metaphorical. You know, nothing was real. And Prabhupada was looking at his book. And when Professor Herbert came in, he sat down. And he saw that Prabhupada was looking at his book. And he said, "Hey, Swamiji, see that book there? You know how long it took me to write that book? It took me 20 years to write that book." Prabhupada looked at the book and looked at the man and said, "Yep, I can tell you there's still mistakes." And said, if you want to really understand Krishna, you should understand Krishna the way these boys and girls are understanding. This is the age of enjoying, and they've given up all those habits in order to worship Krishna and to engaged in devotional service." And Professor Herbert started chuckling away and saying, "Well, I could give up smoking and drinking if I wanted to, but I don't want to." And Prabhupada said, "Yes, therefore you have a long way to go on your spiritual journey." He said, "I would request you to read this book," and handed him a copy of Nectar of Devotion. He said, "And if you will read this book, perhaps this will be of some use to you." So, you know, the conversation ended and Professor Herbert got up and walked out, and we were all sitting there kind of, you know, waiting for the post-mortem, you know, because Prabhupada, we'd always talk to Prabhupada afterwards about, so like, you know, I talked to him, he was a big demon, wasn't he, you know, and Prabhupada was saying nothing. So finally one of us in the room there, I think it was Guru Garanga, said, "He was a big demon, wasn't he, Prabhupada?" Now, this Professor Herbert, by the way, had actually met Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. He had traveled to India in the early years and had met Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati and had traveled to a lot of the other Shankarite Mats schools. And Prabhupada was aware of this. And Prabhupada thought for a moment and said, no, he's not a demon. He says, he's been contaminated because he was associating with Mayavadis. He said, but I saw in his book that he has mentioned the name Krishna many times, and this will benefit him. Now, if anyone was deserving of, you know, the rod of chastisement, you know, is this Professor Herbert, for having, you know, downgraded everything about Krishna consciousness to metaphorical. And here was Prabhupada saying, no, we can understand how he got that way. And look, he's mentioned the name Krishna. We felt like the rug had pulled out from underneath it because we understood something about real compassion. So even though Prabhupada was using strong terms with him, there was a real desire to want this person's best interest. So we can't judge it. You can't judge the behavior of the Mahatmas like that by some external. We get into trouble. See that? Oh my goodness. Did we get into trouble trying to imitate Prabhupada? You know, we'd sit there on the Vyasasana with our eyes closed, you know, and our finger up in the air like Prabhupada. Shah! Krishna, you know, and there's this pretense of, you know, what it meant to be a devotee. And it got in so much trouble, so much trouble. Instead of taking to heart the teachings, we were imitating the external appearance. And tragic. So many people were hurt that way. So don't listen to the essence of it. Don't try to imitate the externals.
Over time, probably definitely criticized one of his god brothers in Mayapur, who had not interacted. Probably asked him, "Can you accommodate some of my men before I build my my building, etc." The guy always was, and he had been Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's right hand man. So, and he several times said he's a gross materialist, this, that, so many things. Then when he left his body in 1976, Prabhupada said, they told Prabhupada in Mayapur in his room, he said, he has gone back to Godhead. And they were, the devotees were like, Prabhupada, you said so many heavy things about that guy. He said, yes, but he has done good service, my Guru Maharaj.
You know what that's like? That's like the Beatles. You know, I mean, people point out, the Beatles, they hated each other after a while. What family doesn't argue? These guys were the closest of friends, so sometimes there's arguments about things. That was another big mistake. And I know this thing is being, broadcast worldwide on the web and yada, 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 it's going to come back to haunt me. But I'll take responsibility for saying this here and now. I don't care who hears it. One of the biggest mistakes we made was not honoring the Vaishnavas. We were so proud of, being Prabhupada Anugas that anyone else became, anathema, And even if there was some anomaly in their teachings, something that wasn't quite like what Prabhupada was teaching and it was different, or, you got to go deeper with our school or you come to this teacher. Is that an excuse for being insulting to people? How dare we? How dare we be so insensitive to people who are, their whole lives are given over to worship of Radha and Krishna, and we don't know how to honor them properly? How shameful of us. Shame on us. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that, but I don't see how we can live with ourselves for the way we've behaved towards some of Prabhupada's godbrothers. I don't see it. Yeah. Namamrita Prabhu.
When I, look at Prabhupada disciples, like I read the book on Jayananda Prabhu, or just reading about, the Goswamis, and for me, it often has the opposite of effect of actually not inspiring me, but making me feel like, I'll never make it, because that's what it takes to go back to Krishna. You have to be a pure devotee. And I'm not trying to find an easy way out or anything, but is there such a thing as over-preparing, just within your own capabilities, even though, compared to, like Jayananda Prabhu, you're just the worst of fallen souls. But is Krishna, compassionate to the point where, like, he'll, you don't have to be that high of a pure devotee, and as long as you're trying your best within your capabilities, that's good enough, or, is it not enough?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, we can always do better, right? We can always do better. I remember Prabhupada coming back from a morning walk in Los Angeles, and the devotees would always line up and then, offer him flowers, and he'd go into the temple. And there was one time, there was one disciple there, and she was just crying and crying and crying and crying. Prabhupada went over and said, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "I'm so full, and I'm not a devotee, I don't love Krishna, I forgot Krishna, I don't do anything for you, I'm just useless, I'm a slave to my senses." And she was going on and on. And she was being sincere about it. She wasn't just hysterical. Prabhupada gave her a little chuck under the chin like this. He said, "Don't live with guilt. Just go on with your service. guilt is a toxic condition. A little bit of guilt may be good, because then it's an incentive to do better, you know. But if you indulge in it, just like an indulgence in anything, you know, it's unhealthy. So, yeah, always, you know, being a little ashamed of how, you know, I really could do better. That's good. That's a good thing. But to the point where it brings you down and you become unhappy and sad, and, you know, it affects people around you, and it affects the quality of your service because you don't have the energy for it, and there's no motivation because you're thinking you're so fallen. Well, that's not healthy. I don't remember Prabhupada ever saying, you know, fall into the pit of self-deprecation and the humiliation of knowing that we have become such crass nothings in the world of the material. And, you know, he said, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You know? And I think he meant it. I really think he meant, do the best you can. Do the best you can. We can never aspire to be so exalted as the Goswami. I mean, that they set an example that was meant to be inspiring to us. You know, not that we should actually try to live under a tree and not eat. I mean, that, you do that and you're going to die. You know, we're supposed to seize the essence of what that example was. It's something to inspire us. So sure, we can always do better. But that life of, you know, pure devotion to that extent, it was never meant to be imitated. That's, and even devotees we've known in our lifetime, you know, like Jayananda Prabhu, for example, very exceptional souls, rare, wonderful, wonderful souls, and being with them really was inspiring. You know, just, yeah, it was great, and you felt, wow, there's hope. You know, look, here's, when I see Radhanath Swami, I think, wow, there's hope. You know, so that's, they're meant to inspire us in that way.
Does it mean we're going to have to come back in the next life and then we'll be at their level? Or is it actually possible to go back to Godhead within this life, even though we're nothing compared to these devotees, but somehow we've tried our best within what we have?
Yeah, I used to worry about what my next life was going to be, and then I learned better. What does it matter? It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what our next life is going to be. This is our life here. This is our life here. You know, how do you know that in your last lifetime you weren't so worried about, you know, being a better devotee that you came back and here you are again worrying about being a devotee? You know, it's like that's a perpetuating feedback loop of anxiety. You know, embrace the great mercy and grace and wonder of the life that we have, with all of its hardships, with all of the challenges that we have to face. We've been given the tools by Prabhupada's grace to meet those challenges, you know, so that not only can our life become happy, but we can become inspirational for other people as well. Just imagine if you are feeling those feelings and you know Krishna consciousness, imagine what other people around you in this terribly problematic world are feeling. And where is their inspiration supposed to come from, if not from you and from me? You know, people want to have hope. They want to see that, it's possible, that even despite all of these terrible, I've got this problem, alcoholic parents, and, you know, a deadbeat husband, and I've got, my child is on drugs, and I've got this going on, and I've lost my job, but look at me, I'm a mess. Because I could be in Baghdad right now, you know. It's true, most of the world, this right here, right now, our life, this is enviable. With all of the problems that we may be thinking we have, 99% of the world would give their eye teeth to live like we're living, because it's so horrible in the rest of the world. What have we really got to complain about, honestly? You know, so we're meant to be grateful, very, very grateful, you know, that we have this opportunity to engage in devotional service, and and just to do the best we can. Just to do the best we can. So live this life. The next life will take care of itself. That's where I'm at these days. You know, I'm less worried about, you know, what happens at the moment of death, and have I got, you know, Krishna, and you know, should I put the picture of Prabhupada before the picture of Krishna, or first Krishna and Prabhupada behind that? You know, like, I've gone through those things. Like, okay, I'm on my deathbed. What do I do? All right, do I want a live kirtan or a recording of Prabhupada? You know, I mean, do I want to be here or in Vrindavan? You know, you go through these. You know, it's like, hello. You know, how about, you know, cleaning up your room, you know? How about taking out the garbage, you know? It's like smelly. Yeah.
You know, sadhus that came to his house. He did one sincere act of love towards Vaishnavas, and he didn't do anything else in that lifetime, and that's what took him back to Godhead, or to being in his, you know, self-realized form. So I think it's important that we don't worry about where we're becoming in this life as far as, like, how elevated we think we are, but more, let's just try to be sincere, because it's going to take care of itself. Whether we seem to be as elevated as other people or not, we should never even worry about that, because Krishna's that merciful.
That's a really good point. That's a really, really good point. One of the biggest mistakes I think we make is judging our own spiritual advancement by looking at others. Maybe this is part of the answer to your question as well. I know I've made this mistake myself, you know, over the years. What appears simple in someone else's devotional life, first of all, it's our impression. You know, oh, look how spiritual, how devotional, you know, that person is. We don't know what that person is actually going through. That experience may be excruciatingly painful for them. So our impression, first of all, is, oh, I can't do that. So we're feeling bad, right? Second thing is, that person could be looking at you and saying, I could never do what that person is doing. I couldn't do that. How does he do that? Gosh, I wish I could do that, you know? So it's always a relative thing, you know? And because Krishna is in our heart, he sees the sincerity of the effort. You know, it's not, sure, results are nice, it's nice to be able to achieve things, but Krishna really does see the sincerity of the effort, and he gives that the priority attention. So I think we can relax about, you know, being impatient. You know, it's nice to be wanting enthusiastically to move forward in our devotional life, but not to the point where it starts making us unhappy or sad or gets in the way of our performing our service. Then it's a harmful thing. So now it's 7 minutes to 9. What do we do? Yes? All right. Well, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.